Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 12th. I'm Ray Graff. It's that time again. It's gardening, and we have a couple of experts here who can help you work through some of your gardening issues. Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum and Bob Graves of Fadigan's Nursery are here. So give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Gardening is a popular show. Get your call in early, 800-348-2551. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. We will have Fred and Bob and you and me and a phone and a radio coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's gardening today, and on the show today, we welcome back Bob Graves, co-owner of Fadigan's Nursery in Latham, New York, and Fred Breglia, director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. You got a gardening question? Give us a call. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Fred and Bob, gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Yeah,
thanks for having us.
Difference in weather from the last time we were here.
It was cold last time, and this time it's hot.
Yeah, it's almost 90 degrees out
there. It was, mid-80s at the Arboretum today.
And the plants seem to be loving it outside.
Oh,
and things are popping up all over the place.
Things are popping like crazy. It happened really fast.
It causes a lot of flowering things to go by quickly, too, when it gets hot like this. Your tulips are going to blow out fast. Your flowering trees are going to blow out fast.
They are. It makes them come in hot and heavy, and they look really good, but the lasting power of that of those flowers, not so much when it stays hot.
Remind people of is, you know, it was cool and rainy. It's not now.
Nope.
If you got new stuff, water it, please.
Exactly. It went right from literally cool and rainy to dry out there. And we are talking
days. Really
dry.
Yeah, it's really dry.
Yep. I actually seen cracks in the in the actual soil. And you don't usually see that, at least for a while.
Yeah.
Cracks in the soil? What do you mean?
You get those soil cracks at the surface. When it gets dry enough, you'll actually see the earth.
It shrinks.
It shrinks, yeah. And actually you'll get cracking when it's severe drought. And I don't think I've ever seen it quite this early on where you get those large cracks in the soil, but we're already getting it.
Well, what'd you bring, Fred?
Today we got some wild ramps here for you, Ray, to take home.
Nice.
Allium tricoccum. They're sort of a North American version of wild leek.
Yeah.
They're in the onion family, and they're really, really tasty. You do want to be careful when you're, you know, I tell people when they forage them, because it's really easy to over forage ramps.
I've heard that.
Populations are actually even at threat because of over foraging, and a lot of people sell them or whatever. I've been using the same ramp patch since I was like 11 years old, and I can only say that the ramp patch has expanded prolifically over the past 20 something 30 years of me getting them, and I've even helped to propagate them around.
Right?
They transplant well, so you can actually move them around, and I've started new patches here or there. But if you've never had them, you're in for a treat. It's a cross between an onion and a garlic, and use them like you would. And the leaves make an unbelievably great pesto.
Oh.
So enjoy. Bon appetito.
Outstanding.
Right?
Thanks, man. All right, a couple of emails here. Actually, few, and then we'll get to the phones. 800-348-2551. This is from Ann and Adams. Oh, this is great. You know what? One thing I love about our listeners is they know that I am not too good with words and I can't read very well. Hi, Ray. I hope all is good with you. Apologies for the difficult words. Well, thank you, Ann. Question, is there a rhododendron that can handle full New England summer sun for most of the day? I hear lepidolite rhodes can handle it, but where do I find them? Also, I wonder if Nova Zembla can take the sun. That's from Ann and Adams.
You know, in general, the small-leafed rhodes, the PJM types, would be better in full sun. But even then, it depends. You know, Nova Zembla is a Catalbiens type. It does not really want to be in full sun.
No, it has that fatter leaf.
It's got the big leaf on it. You know, morning sun is great, some afternoon sun. But it's a combination of things. You get a lot of sunny areas and wind. You know, it's the wintertime that hurts them. So if you're in a spot where it's going to get a lot of wind and sun, I don't really recommend rhodes in full hot sun.
Not really, no. And like you said, those PJMs, if they were going to do one,
would
that
be
old
better.
Smaller leafed variety can handle more, but not with that kind of wind and sun.
You got to be careful.
You got to be careful.
All right, this one's from Jim in Glenmont, and another word I can't say, but he's not apologizing, so we'll just go ahead with it, and I'll butcher the word. Afternoon panel, a soil question. Last year, I bought two rectangular patio planters with legs to grow vegetables. I used ProMix with mycorrhizae.
Mycorrhizae, that too,
as the only soil. The plants faltered midsummer, maybe because if all the rain. If I want to try it again, would you suggest the same soil mix alone, or should I mix in another soil too? I did add some compost last year.
Well, it depends. That particular mix is one that dries out really quick, so it would be not a bad thing to have in a rainy year. But usually in pots outside, I find it to be a little too quick to dry. You know, something that's a little bit heavier than that might be a good option. I would not mix anything in the way of compost or exterior soil in with pots because you can end up introducing a lot of fungal and disease problems.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's you get into trouble when you start to add those organic elements, and they work really, really well for your gardens.
Right.
But when you put them in containers,
it's a whole different deal.
It's a different environment, and it really does kind of create more of problems than solutions. So if you mixed compost in that media in the past, compost is just going to make the water holding capacity more, which in that sense it can help, but not the other problems that you're going to get with it.
Most of your potting soils are sterile to start with.
Yeah, they are.
And what you want.
He could probably get away with that ProMix. I mean, I have used ProMix in containers. You just got to keep on them.
You got to watch the water.
Yep. What I like about ProMix is that it doesn't actually compact well.
Right.
So, you know, in terms of getting your crops in there and getting good aeration, wonderful.
Did you guys see that the scientists down one of the universities in Florida grew plants with soil that they brought back from Apollo 11?
Oh, wow. Well, no, I didn't see that. That's neat.
And I forget what kind of plant. I mean, I read it during the news, but my memory is so terrible that I can't remember the plant.
I'm not the astronomy guy, but didn't the moon come from the Earth?
Well, that's a leading theory.
I'm not the guy to answer.
All right, fine. Well, you want to come on the astronomy show? All right, because I'll take the day off. You can host. This is from Rich. I recently removed some large trees, stumps, roots, and all from an area in front of my home. I'm interested in installing a low-maintenance lawn alternative that would be wildlife-friendly, not necessarily shrubs, as I have them in abundance. The area gets good morning and afternoon sun with shade around the edges of an approximately 100 by 50-foot area. This is a primarily wooded rural property in eastern Fulton County with clay/loam soil. And that's from Rich.
Well, you know, lawn is the easiest thing to take care of, bar none. But you're not going to use pachysandra or vermurtal or euonymus or anything like that because you can't walk on it. If you did some ferns, maybe if it's partially shaded, it's something of that sort.
Yeah, you could also probably do some wildflower mixes like turf. I would recommend more wildflower mixes. Cultivate that or loosen that soil up a little bit. Drop in a bunch of wildflower seeds. Some of those wildflower seeds are going to like it, and others, and they're going to come up and grow that year, and they won't come back again. Others are going to actually be able to continue to grow there.
Often
it's
overtaken that next year by one or two varieties that do well.
Exactly.
But basically, it sounds like a meadow.
It sounds like a meadow, and I think if you treated it more meadow-like, you'd end up with potentially some great pollinator plants. Certainly a lot more interesting than turf. Certainly no offense meant on that one.
Bob, you said you can't walk on pachysandra? Are you not allowed? I do that all the time.
Well, if it's routine, you're going to hurt it.
You're going to crush the stems right down.
Yeah, oh, rats.
Your pachysandra's got to be that tall, so every time you walk on it, it doesn't come back that tall, generally.
Rats. All right, well, I guess I've been screwing up the last 20 years, but you know what? It has receded a little bit. It's probably my own fault.
Most things are, aren't they?
Sorry. All right, last two more emails, then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Gardening Today with Bob Graves of Fadigan's Nursery and Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. This one's from Tim at the 845. Happy spring. Do you cut daffodils back after blooming? And if so, how far?
Very simple question there.
Yep, real good one.
Once the flowers are gone, you have to let the leaves mature till they turn yellow, die, and dry off, because that's where you're putting the energy back into the bulb. Mm-hmm. And once they're dead and dry, you can cut them off.
Yeah, and that's kind of, for the most part, the general consensus for most of your bulbs. Your tulips, the same exact way. Don't cut that green foliage off. Let it get yellow, kind of starts to die right back. all that energy is going right back in the bulbs. So almost all of your spring bulbs are pretty much, I can't think of an example where that's not the case. So
yep. They got to feed that bulb.
All right, this last one for now from the email bag from Ellen in Troy. Ornamental allium edible, question mark. Aside from the chives in my herb garden, I have drumstick and hair allium in my flower beds. They smell distinctly oniony when cut down, and I'm wondering if they are edible. Are all allium edible?
I don't have enough information to answer that. That's legally a dangerous question.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I'd say when in doubt, don't, because you just don't know if it is. And I would say that, you know, the regular alliums that we eat are general. You never see the ornamentals available for sale. So there's a, you know, there's a lot of ways to die. Choose something fun.
Very well played. Ellen wants to know what the bassy tune is that closes Vox Pop, and that is one of my all-time favorite arrangements. That is called Slew Foot, and Neil Hefti arrangement and composition, and it's just spectacular. Late 50s era bassy. I think it's on Bassy Plays Hefti, which was originally released on Roulette years and years ago. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Gardens and you and your phone calls coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. It's Gardening Today with Fred Breglia and Bob Graves. And very quickly, before we get to the phones, Fred, you got big doings going on over at the Landis.
We do. Our big weekend, big spring plant sale is this coming weekend, Saturday and Sunday. It's going to start at 10, run till 4. We have an arsenal of plants this year, a lot of Landis-grown plants that we have, flowering baskets, fruit trees, you name them, hardy peaches. We have all your garden veggie plants, starts. We have herbs. We have an incredible variety of ornamentals, some really unique and unusual plants. We have a great used book sale. We also have a really good bake sale at landisarboretum.org. That's our website. It's a one-stop shop for all things Landis. And this weekend sale, 10 to 4, Saturday and Sunday.
That is exciting stuff. Bob Graves, you came in. You looked pretty tired. I said, what's going on? You said, it's a little busy over at the shop. Anything going on over there?
Spring happened really quick.
It got hot.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, stuff is coming in so fast now. We have a hard enough time getting it off the truck and off the shelves.
It's exciting, though. I mean,
oh, my goodness.
There's so much fun.
Everybody is pent-up demand. They want to get outside because it was so cold and nasty for so long.
Yeah. It really was. It was a tough spring.
You know, I was thinking about that this morning driving in. I said, we had winter, and then we had about a week of spring, and then it's summer.
Yeah, and it seems to kind of do that quite a bit lately. The last handful of years, we end up that way. It'd be nice to have a transition that's kind of normal.
At least we don't have the fires that they have out west.
Yeah. I know.
All right, let's go to the phones. Betsy in Massachusetts. Betsy, you're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, it's actually Betsy. I was calling because, unfortunately, I seem to have just about every invasive plant known to man in my yard, specifically bittersweet and bishop's weed. And I don't know if there's any particularly good way of getting rid of either, you know, aside from just, like, killing everything in the garden and getting everything out and starting over, or... You know, any suggestions?
Yep, your bittersweet, that one you could actually sort of eradicate by continuously cutting that one now because it's probably just leafed out, is my guess. And if you let it leaf out and use that stored energy up, because it doesn't have leaves before that, so it can't photosynthesize, so it uses stored energy to leaf out, and then it puts those leaves out, and those are... leaves are just little tiny solar panels. They have to make the food and keep the plant going, but you don't want them to do that, so you cut them right after they leaf out, and then the plant will put out another residual growth because it's survival. It'll try to pull out more growth and put out some more leaves, and then watch for that, because as soon as it does, it's doing that through stored energy. Cut it again, and you'll very rapidly run that plant out of energy. Just don't miss them, because if you get a little shoot here or there, they could photosynthesize and make that plant kind of have energy again. But you can wear it out, and, right. and it's not too hard to do it if you keep after it. Don't let it grow. This is the ideal time to get it.
Excellent. Is that true also of Rosa rugosa?
It is. Any woody plant, for the most part, that is an invasive, you could wear it out. And even if it's not an invasive, it's a woody plant in a spot where you don't want it. And poison ivy, for example, that's a native that actually has a lot of wildlife benefits, but it does give people rashes. A lot of people are allergic to it, so they don't want it in their garden.
Right.
So how do you get rid of poison ivy this time of year? Same exact answer. Just cut it. It's going to go away. So anything woody is really, you know, doing that through stored energy. And even your agapodium or your bishop's weed, if you can mow it close enough, you'll get rid of it. Now, that's a little tricky when it's actually in the garden.
You can dig it out. That one's a little easier. The bittersweet's tough to dig.
It is. The agapodium is easy to dig, but it fragments off.
But you got to just keep doing it and doing it. Same thing. Got to keep after it.
So I've dug out this Rosa rugosa down to about a foot below ground surface, and it just keeps coming back.
Yeah. keep watching for the new growth. It cannot live if it doesn't have those little solar panels we call leaves on them. So it has to die. There's no way around it. It just wears out of energy. So as long as you're a bit more persistent than that plant, you'll win that battle. Now, that agapodium, you also could smother. So if it's in an area of the garden where you don't have a lot of good plants, you could literally smother that whole area with like a black plastic or a weed fabric that I wouldn't use for landscapes, but I would use for smothering plants. That would totally... Cool. No way it's living under that.
You cook it, basically. You cook it.
Yep, and just suffocate it from any kind of light, and it's going to shut down. You could mow it really close.
Wonderful.
Yep, so all those ways, and I've used all of the above to do it.
All right, Betsy, thank you very much for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, Gardening with Bob Graves and Fred Breglia. Harvey is in Altamont. Harvey, you're on.
Hello, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Hello. All right. It's funny. My call came right after Betsy's. Live in Altamont. It's an old manor house, like a Victorian big thing. We've got about 10 acres.
Yeah.
About eight of which are woods and two of which are, you know, pretty landscaped. And they've got a lot of really nice hardwoods, you know, like maples, oaks, shagbark, hickory, black walnuts, things like that. But over the last couple of years, we've been fighting the battle of the buckthorn.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, yeah.
I know
but
that
I think they actually found a way to, yes. I think I actually found a way to get rid of it. And what I do is I take, and probably about knee high, thigh high, something like that, so you don't have to keep bending down. You cut it off, and depending on the thickness of it and how it's grown, but then you take like a hatchet, or maybe a knife, and you take like a rubber mallet. What you want to do is you want to cut a slit in the cut that you made down an inch or two. And then what you do is you take some of it, like a high concentrate of a weed killer type of thing, and you put it in a like a sherbet container, you know, like a pint-sized container.
Yeah.
And with a lid on it. And once you cut it, you take the sponge brush and you dip it in there and you dab in the into that crack that you've cut in that area, and it seems to actually probably about 85-90% you can get rid of it on the first try.
Well, Harvey, I don't have any reason to disbelieve you, as I know nothing about gardening, even though I've done 1,000 of these shows. However, Bob Graves is shaking his head over there.
Well, the same thing that Fred just said applies. If you don't want to use chemical pesticides, you just keep whacking it and whacking it and whacking it and whacking it if you can. There's lots of different pesticides that you can use that way if you put it on a fresh cut. But some people don't want to do that.
Yeah, and honestly, you don't really have to, because I've got a pretty bad buckthorn problem at Landis Arboretum. You know, it was planted by our founder in '51. There is a native buckthorn, and you know, not to be confused. So not all buckthorns are bad, but there's that common buckthorn, Rhamnus cathartica, is one of those invasives. So our founder Fred Lay planted that, and then as you can imagine, it did pretty well on our site. So now we're cutting it down, of course. And the way we get rid of it all is just how we answered that question before. Just, you got to get it timing wise. Right now in the spring, let it leaf out, cut it right down to the ground. let it leaf out again, cut it again, your problems are solved. No sprays, no chemicals, and it works really, really well. But it only works this time of year. If you let it photosynthesize all summer and then try to take it down,
it's got
a lot of stored energy in those root systems. You got it. So it's timing on this one.
Go ahead, Arby.
Yeah, timing is everything. But I agree. It's just that we don't really have the option of going back and time and time and time again. Ours is, we rent it out in the summertime for weddings and so forth, and so we really have to do it and try to keep it down. And then the other thing is the other 2 acres are pretty much landscaped, and, you know, weeding is you're getting down on your hands and knees anyhow. And we have a lot of, peonies, which are kind of like stalky. You know, all your stuff is at the top, and the same thing, we probably have 130 hydrangeas. And
wow.
the stuff starts to get in there, and you can't get rid of it. So what I've done, you take small pieces of cardboard, you cut them in different sizes,
yeah.
Let's say like 4x4, 4x6, something like that.
Yeah,
and then you kind of bend them in half. Sort of looks like a Victorian dressing screen, that kind of a thing. It's like a V on its side.
Do you guys ever hear about this?
You
guys ever do that? Bob?
No, I cut things.
You like cut Fred. Things.
We cut them, yeah, generally.
Even brush hogs.
Yeah, hang on a second.
All right, very quick, Harvey. We got a lot of calls. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. You put it behind the plant you want, that you want to kill. It protects it from the stalk, and then you take the chemicals in a spray, Windex bottle or something like that, so that protects it, and
okay.
The cardboard absorbs it. So it's like a laser missile, you know?
Right.
It really gets rid of them.
All right.
Without digging.
I'm glad it's working for you, Harvey. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. And looks like everybody on the phone on my screen is showing the same duration on hold. So something went wrong with the computer, and there'll be some people who have waited a really long time. I don't know who they are. Let's go to Chris in Cornwall. Chris.
Yeah. Hi, Ray. Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on. I have a question about wood poppies. My wife and I drove 45 minutes last year up to a nursery in the Catskills to get some small plants and put them in the garden. And they just came up this year, and they're doing pretty good. And then lo and behold, I've got them coming up wild through the gravel driveway. So my question is whether I can transplant those out of the gravel. They seem to like that hot, dry soil there, and whether I can put them in the garden.
Well, you could certainly try. It's hard in that situation to dig something up properly because you've got a real hard substrate there to get the roots out in one piece.
Yep. But a lot of times it breaks apart when you try to dig those out.
You have
out
nothing
of those hard
to lose
spots.
By trying. Sure.
Yep. You could certainly also let them go to seed,
yeah.
And then get the seeds, and you might have more luck that way potentially. They root pretty. They do pretty good from seed. My gut feeling in that driveway is if you try to move them, you'd probably lose some of the root and maybe get them to wilt, and they might not make it through the season. But if you have to move them, you don't want them there, then you got nothing to lose. If you have time, let them flower, go to seed, and then collect the seed, and then you'll be in good shape.
All right.
You can move them then, too, after they're dormant. They could probably, but they are more of an annual.
All right, Chris, thank you very much for that one. We go to Matt in Northampton. Matt, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
My question for the experts is, what evidence do they have that using the herbicides, according to the label, on these invasive species is a bad idea, either for the health of people or the health of the planet? It seems to me that, in my experience, causing disturbance by digging it creates a much bigger impact. And like what the previous caller said, just, you know, putting a little dab with a sponge dabber or one of the buckthorn blasters onto the stem, you can walk away and get it done. And it just seems like I know they're chemicals and they are poisons, but so are a lot of things we use in our daily lives, like vaccines or chemotherapy in the case of cancer. It just strikes me that they're
it's very right, man. Useful it's a fair tools question.
If they're applied correctly.
It's a very detailed question.
Yep.
I went to a seminar.
We've applied 300 million pounds of glyphosate every single year in the United States, and you don't see everybody falling over and dying.
Well, I went to a seminar one time that was an entire day on Roundup and glyphosate. It all depends on what research you're looking at. It's very complicated. Some of the damage that people are seeing as a consequence of that is from really severe exposure from glyphosate. You know, some of the people who've had real trouble with that got sprayed with it, you know. But in terms of
for applying 300 million pounds a year, you'd think there'd be more than one or two people who are suffering the effects.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not going to
debate
Matt, that.
Hey Matt, let me tell you something. We have a science forum and we have chemists and biology people on, and I encourage you to call with this question again. These guys are gardeners. They are not scientists.
Yeah,
have their opinions, but sure, you should call for a scientific question on our science forum.
And just an FYI, a lot of the stuff we're not saying, you know, don't use anything. There's always exceptions to the rules, but if you could control something pretty readily, just by cutting it, not digging, actually cutting is what we were talking about. It actually controls real easy. So I guess I would save the nasty stuff for more of a real problem.
Sometimes we don't know for years the impact that things are going to have.
Yeah.
When I started in this business 50 years ago, one of the ingredients that was in a broadleaf weed killer was Agent Orange.
Yep.
We didn't know back then.
That's true. DDT was a big one.
You learn things over time.
Yeah, but I think Matt's question is a fair one.
It's a fair question.
And I think we should ask the chemical engineers and such about these questions. I don't know the answer. All right, we go to a different story. Joanne in Queensbury. Joanne, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a small row of strawberries that the past couple of years I haven't had the opportunity to eat any of those strawberries because either the birds one year got them, so I put that remake on them last year, and then the chipmunks got underneath the remake, and I didn't have a single berry last year. Is there any way to solve that issue?
You know, fencing. little small fencing. Especially when you say small row. When you talk about a large garden, it gets different. But small row, you could use like hardware cloth, if you know what that is. It's basically like a type of...
you're basically trying to make a cage.
Yeah, you're trying to make a cage over it. It's the hardware cloth, it's really confusing title for it, a name for it, because it doesn't it's not made out of cloth. It's like wire.
It's like a quarter inch by quarter inch.
Yeah, but it's
like
quarter
that.
Inch by quarter
small.
Inch hole.
Not chicken wire. Chicken
right,
wire
exactly. And no chipmunk, no mouse, nothing can get through it. We use it for vole guards around a lot of our trees at the Arboretum to protect them for the wintertime damage, but it would certainly keep chipmunks out. And if you have a small one, it comes in a roll, and you could just kind of make a fence around it, and you could even put a little top on it, and rain and water, everything goes through it, sunlight, and is guaranteed there's no way to chipmunks.
So growing marigolds would they discourage the chipmunks from coming?
Not the chipmunks. No. Marigolds and planted a lot of times can help with nematodes in gardens.
You know what, Joanne? But usually what Fred recommends is you put a chipmunk head on a spike out of the garden.
No.
All right, I take that back. He doesn't. Must have been
that was the Japanese
cloth.
Beetle.
Hardware.
That was the Japanese
at a
beetle.
Home center or a hardware store.
All right, Joanne, you want to follow up here one more time before we go move on?
No, I'm good. Thanks. Okay. I'll try the hardware cloth.
Right, yeah, and if we get it at any hardware store, any of those places would have it. It comes in a roll. You are going to need a pair of like tin snips to cut it. It's
be
gonna
careful,
make your life easier.
Joanne, because it they call it cloth, but it's really sharp. I have cut my fingers to shreds on
good
that
point.
Stuff.
Good point. It does. When you cut it, it leaves those little edges. I've poked myself countless times.
Yep. All right, Joanne, thanks a lot. Good luck. We appreciate it. Carol is in Catskill. Carol, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling because I want to know, is there a way you can pollinate the tomato plants without using the bees to pollinate the blossoms?
Sure. You take a little paintbrush, little brush, and you go you go from flower to flower. There's some places in the world where in Asia where they're pollinating all their fruit trees because they've lost all their pollinators.
That's right. Yeah, so that definitely works real gentle with a paintbrush, dry paintbrush.
Seen a lot of bees this year.
I've seen a lot of bees this year myself.
How can you tell?
Go ahead, Carol.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to ask you, how can you tell from a female blossom and a male blossom? Well, I've heard that before, but
I just
going to
hit them all.
Is there a way to tell, though?
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, you can tell a male from a female flower, but it needs a microscope to do it.
Okay.
Yeah. So just get small plant parts you're looking at.
All right, Carol. Yep. Hey, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Gardening Today with Fred Breglia and Bob Graves. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Gardening Today with Bob Graves and Fred Breglia. The number to call is 800-348-2551. This email from Sherry. Please tell the gentleman from the Arboretum. Well, we have someone here from the Arboretum. I don't know if he's a gentleman. There was a 400-year-old oak in the Victory Woods portion of the Saratoga National Historic Park. It fell several years ago. Something is slowly killing the other oaks, many of them approximately 300 years old. I remember him mentioning 400-year-old oaks on an earlier show, and that is from Sherry.
Very cool. Yeah, I actually looked at the fallen giant. That was it was a gigantic, I believe, swamp white oak, and we had heard a tip that that tree was in there, so we went to find it, and we did, and it was fallen when we found it. But ironically, we actually measured it in its fallen state, and the numbers looked like it could have been a potential state champion. So it was a really, really big one. And, you know, unfortunately, the really big trees, you know, they do get to a certain age, and we start to lose them. But there's always, you know, room for another big one to kind of come up every time we lose a big one. And we certainly lost a really big one at the Landis Arboretum. We had one there that was pushing 500 years old, one of the oldest oaks in the entire state,
wow,
if not the Northeast. And we lost that to Hurricane Irene. And we did plant a new one, and there's a lot of other big ones around. But we're always looking for more big ones. So if you see any large, you know, giants out there that you're wondering, hey, I wonder if this could be the next big one,
yeah,
shoot me an email, fred@landisarboretum.org, and, you know, I'd be happy to see it. Send me some photos. I can give you more info on it. And if it's big enough, I'll come out and actually officially measure it for you.
All right, this one's from Teresa. Fertilizing raised bed veggies garden. Are there general rules of thumb for fertilizing raised bed veggie garden throughout the season? How frequently should it be done? Is side dressing with compost sufficient? And that's from Teresa.
Well, there's, you know, we sort of on this program like organic fertilizers, you know, complete organic fertilizers. You can't hurt anything with them. It's good to supplement. You know, you can put, you really with your compost, you'd like to mix it in before you even plant rather than just side dressing with it. How often you fertilize depends on what the product is and what the recommendations are. Some things you can do once a month, some every 2 months, some you need to do every 10 days, depends on what it is.
Some is every other watering, depending if you're using a soluble and you want to bump it up. It also depends a lot on what you got in that raised bed. Like a lot of raised bed folks fill it with like we talked about, like a potting media, like a ProMix type, which is all neutral. But a lot of other folks say with raised beds, they're different than planters. They have an open bottom. They don't have a closed bottom, so they're not actually a planter.
Right.
And with that, you have a soil connection. So you could use more organic composts in there. And I've seen, you know, great results. And if you're using a lot of organic compost, there's a lot of nutrition in there. You might not need quite as much, or at least for a few seasons. But top dressing compost is not a bad thing at all. And we do that with all of our gardens. We do that with any raised bed. But I wouldn't do it with planters, like Bob said. I wouldn't mix organics like that in with, pots, you know, a compost in pots with, like, sterile growing medias. So it sort of depends, I guess. I don't know if we answered that question 100%.
Okay.
But what your desired results are, what you're trying to achieve, what you're planting, all vary a lot. But a lot of options out there.
This one's from Eliza. I know it's a cliche, but I'm in search of the Holy Grail, the perfect homegrown tomato. I got the dreaded fungus that a lot of people got, and now I have to plant them somewhere else, somewhere that I'm not sure of the soil quality. I'm willing to buy whatever I need to set up my plants for that perfect tomato, but what should I buy to ensure good soil for the best tomato? I buy plants. When's the best time to put them in?
Well, what I like to say with compost is as many different types of things as you can get. You know, if you want to buy some stuff in bags, buy different types of stuff in bags. If you've got some homemade compost, use that. If you can get it from the municipality, you can use that. But you're inoculating that soil with nutrients and microbial activity. So the more different types of things you have, sometimes the better.
Yeah, and check pHs. I really can't emphasize checking pHs enough.
Especially with compost. The last load we got was 8.0.
Wow, and I have some at home that's running on like 3.5.
Oh, really?
So 3.5. Wow. So, and it's really good. It's black gold, really good compost. But it's, you know, you're putting it into a garden, and it's going to end up being okay. It'll actually drop that soil pH a little bit.
Yeah.
But you plant nothing but that.
Oof.
That pH is not the best. So it's not too hard to get an accurate pH test. You could buy a kit. You could take it in New York to Cooperative Extensions. You could buy a pretty expensive meter. You could buy a pretty simple kit. Either way, they're pretty accurate. They are only as good as the user, so you have to make sure that the sample of soil you kind of make together creates a random sample, and you sort of test that random sample to get a good range of your pH, because if you want the perfect tomato, you're going to need the perfect pH.
All right, fair enough.
And good watering schedule.
We have so many emails, so many calls. This is the last email for now, and then we'll hit the phones again. This is from Kay in Cornwallville. No mow May, truth or fiction? Two question marks.
Oh, we haven't mowed this May, so we're definitely truth. We're going for maybe a no mow June and May.
Well, I mean, what? Now, this is just to help. What's the point?
Because there's a lot of late season pollinators that use those flowers that come out. So you need those pollinators really early on before we get all the other flowers that pop out the rest of the year, and there's plenty of food. So that gives you a chance to give those pollinators food early on. Also, you're saving tremendous amounts of fuel. And on top of that, if you're actually looking for healthier turf, leaving it through May and then cutting it high is actually going to give you better roots, which means better turf.
Got to be a little careful in your neighborhood or in your town, because if it gets a little too tall, the town's not too happy.
You know
about
what?
It.
I'm going to do no mow May, June, July, and August.
We signed on for May. I think we're going to go for June, too.
Back to the phone.
Neighbors may not like it.
Yeah. You know what? I try not to annoy them, but maybe this time, just this once.
We're kind of like that.
Elizabeth in Albany. Elizabeth, you're on.
Hi. I'm starting a bed for Siberian iris in an area of my backyard that has morning sun but hasn't had any planting. So I want to prepare the soil, and I don't know what to add and how deep to plant the bulbs.
Well, as we've said several times, I think the best thing is some compost of various types if you can get it. Kind of turn it in a little bit. Depends on the quality of the soil. I mean, if it's really good ground, you don't need much.
That's true.
Yeah. It's Albany, with all of the clay mixture with it, that kind of soil.
Yeah, the good news is you said Siberian iris, right?
Right.
Yeah, they actually sort of like, or at least can certainly grow really well in clay.
Yeah, so, they don't mind it.
Yeah, they don't mind it. We have a clay-type soil at the Arboretum, and boy, you can't stop them.
Really?
Brown side down, green side up, it works. So
they're pretty shallowly planted too, right?
Yeah, they are. They form big clumps, and they're, you know, moisture. They like moisture, so you know, getting them some moisture. Okay. They don't like to be really, really bone dry, but and they like you know, probably more sun than shade, but they can tolerate shade too. So you should be pretty good with
those.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for the call. It's Gardening Today. Fred Breglia, director of the Landis Arboretum, and Bob Graves, co-owner of Fatigan's Nursery. And, you know, we had the great reset on the phones here. So I'm just going to go to Stuart in Broad Auburn. Stuart, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I want to do a quick shout out because last year I called in the early summer. All my flowering crab apples had lost all their leaves. You folks said it was because of mold, and they would come back, and indeed they did come back. So a point for your team.
Nice.
Great.
Is that it?
But my question today is up in Broad Auburn, I've got daylilies in front of my house, and they've always done great, and they actually choked out some of the hostas. They're really healthy. And last year, the deer had a picnic on them, just picked every single flower off those plants.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. I've been told that chili powder will inhibit that.
Chili powder can help.
Is it?
Rotten eggs, there was sort of a Deer Be Gone recipe. I don't know if it's still on the Landis Arboretum website. I think it is. It would be landisarboretum.org. And if not, you can send me an email. I could easily give it to you. Or I could just say roughly what it is. It's basically some rotted eggs. Rotten eggs work great. I like to throw in, and everyone's got a little concoction, I like to throw in some fresh garlic in that concoction because they don't like garlic. Keeps the deer out and the vampires. Got everything in between. The chili powder is not a bad idea. The biggest thing with that kind of Deer Be Gone recipe is it works, but only if you reapply it. It dries.
That's the problem with daylilies. Those flowers are coming out so fast, and if you don't hit it, it doesn't work.
You cover the area with it. I mean, fencing's another option. If I don't know if that's an option for you, but you know, some they make some great
not
fencing.
Not really, no.
Okay.
Yeah, you just got to keep, you know, almost daily.
But yeah, if you sprayed it out there quite a bit, I mean, it's going to be pretty profuse, but in terms of the smell, but the deer should definitely go away. So I think it's just a matter of keeping on it. Get them through that. Once they open up, they're safe.
You know, I was taking the kids. Thanks, Stuart, for the call. Yeah. I was taking some of the girls for a ride, and we saw on a lawn this guy who had a giant Bigfoot statue.
I've seen those around.
They're really cool.
They are really cool.
Now, if you put that out there, would it inhibit the deer? Would they get scared?
I'm not sure.
I got a dog in the backyard that would tear them apart if it could get to them, and they don't care.
Yeah, I've tried, and I've got my little boy Fred and Mike at home, and it doesn't seem to scare
them.
They want to go camping back there, so I don't think the deer are going to mind either.
You know, they're going to look at it and say, "Ah, it's not moving. Come on, guys."
Well, no. Okay. All right. So you need to make it move. Okay.
We need a motion one of those.
We need a robotic Bigfoot.
Now
in the back.
Now we're talking.
Let's go to Dave in Altamont. Dave, you're on.
Yeah, hi, thanks, guys. I have some spruce trees, and I think I have spruce needle cast. They are not densely planted. I've read that if you get them clumped together, then they can't dry out, and that's what causes it. And I'm wondering what I can do to treat them. They're probably about 30 feet tall. I've recently planted some new Fat Albert spruce that I'm told can spread to them. I'm trying to prevent that.
So you're talking about are Colorado blue spruce?
Yes.
Yeah. It is needle cast. It's a fungus that gets them, and unfortunately, it's a horrible disease. It wipes them out. In fact, most arborists and landscapers aren't really using or recommending blue spruce anymore. It isn't just the blue spruce. It'll actually take the Colorados, which are green as well.
It's not so bad on Norways yet, is that right?
No, it's not as bad on Norways. They get it a little bit. And those are the kinds of things where, last resort, there's a sort of a chemical treatment. There is a chemical treatment for that. If you try to get an organic route for that or try to do that by pruning out the dead branches, you will eventually lose the spruce. So this is one of those things where you want to save it. You'll have to.
Being close together isn't necessarily the problem. It's this disease is out there. It just shows up.
It is. Even if there was tons of space between them, you would still probably get it. Maybe it's a little more prolific because they're closer together and you can jump from one to the other. But trust me, it's not anything you've done wrong with these. It's unfortunately a really nice plant that has a problem that can be treated.
If you're going to treat it, really, you got to do it this time of year as the new growth comes out, right?
It's right. I was going to say it is this time of year. You'd have to call one of the classic companies that does that.
There is a generic. I think the generic chemical is chlorothalonil is the one that's used most.
I don't know what it is,
Can you repeat that chemical again?
I think it's chlorothalonil. That's the generic term.
Yeah, and probably something that you're not a homeowner could get. I'm pretty sure that's got to be registered, and you'd have to have it. Yeah, and then you'd have to have the equipment to really coat that. And those the people that do that for a living have all that equipment. Okay. And they know what to do, so it's safe as well.
Yeah, so it's nothing I can do.
No, it's not. It's if you want to save them, you got to think about it. If it's something where you could say, I don't know. What I would suggest is if you got some really good specimen that looks really good, try to save those ones. The ones that are really bad, they're dying from the bottom up is my guess as well, correct?
Yeah, they are.
Yep. So the ones that are dead, they're not coming back. And if your 3/4 branches on that thing are dead, then that's safe to say, save your money on that one. And that's a removal. But if you got some real nice ones out there and you want to keep them that way, That's what it's going to take, unfortunately. But it is possible.
Dave, hey, man, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Mandy in East Greenbush. Mandy.
Hi. I've got a, backyard full of rhododendrons from like 4 feet to, oh, my God, huge. And they have brown leaves. And some of them, I've had that happen in the past, but like some of them like brown curled up leaves. Almost looks like a plant.
All right.
Trying to get some fertilizer. Just wondering, any ideas?
Yeah, Mandy, your signal's cutting in and out. I think you may have some phone issues, but I think we have enough to work with.
Oh,
go ahead, fellas.
Yep, we
there's,
do.
You know, there's some a certain amount of winter kill that occurred this year because it was really windy and cold at times. I've also seen a lot of damage due to rhododendron borer, which is an insect that attacks the lower parts of the branches. And you'd want to look and see if you see any kind of holes or damage. I've seen a lot of it this year, actually, which would make it worse. Yep. But if it's just winter kill, it's not going to be too bad.
Yeah, and you might be able to tell because the borer, if it's bad, it'll have the whole stem on
right.
that branch kind of dying. And winter kill will rarely have the whole stem. It will generally just be some of the external leaves.
All right, I think we lost Mandy again.
Yep.
Mandy, thanks a lot for that one. This email
comes right back, so no problem.
Rennie writes, I started a new lawn 2 years ago. I use a combination of different seeds. My lawn has been overtaken by a weed that looks like a clover. It's very, very tough to pull out and grows rapidly, much higher than the lawn, so it looks very bumpy. Is there a solution to this very annoying problem? If I keep putting down lots of grass seed, will it eventually crowd out the weeds? And that's from Rennie.
You know, in that situation, it's really hard to get control without using a broadleaf weed killer, which will not hurt the grass, but will kill the weeds. But, you know, if you don't want to do that, then no, there's no realistic way to get rid of it at this point. There is an iron-based organic weed killer, but it's not available in large quantities, and it gets a little pricey.
Why does iron do the job?
Iron in heavy enough concentrations will kill some types of plants.
Yeah, another option for a spot, you know, this would not be a solution, but it would help, would be there's some other products out there that are weed killers that use like a combination of either heavy percentages of vinegar combined with citrus oils. And they're really foliar burners. They don't really kill the root. Enough vinegar down there will, but then you wouldn't get much coming back. But the foliar burners that they sell, you could sort of spot spray. So you go around your lawn and you see the stuff that you don't want. You could spray those. You're not going to hurt any insects. You're not going to have any residuals. It's not going to hurt you.
Just a side thing on vinegar. We sell a concentrated vinegar for weed control. It's a 48-hour reentry. You're not supposed to go into that area after you apply
it. No animals,
right? 48 hours.
Yeah, hardcore vinegars are extreme.
It's nasty stuff.
It really is. And a lot of people think, you know, straight vinegar out of the bottle, that's like 3%, I believe.
Yeah, this is like 20%.
Yeah, agricultural grades are like 20-plus.
Well, we only got about 30 seconds here. This is from Joy. I am a new gardener. I need help. I'd love a wildflower lawn to attract bees and birds, etc. Can I simply throw the seeds on the ground? Do they need watering? What type of seed should I buy? Where are wild seeds sold? And that's from Joy. We got 30 seconds.
Yeah, there's a lot of wildflower mixes out there that could work. I don't think you're going to just be able to sprinkle it on the grass because the grass is very competitive and it's actually quite it's better at getting the materials, nutrients that it needs from the soil than the wildflower. So if you want to get a good wildflower meadow,
you got to till it up.
You got to kind of break that soil up a little bit. And
we did that, but the robins ate all the seeds. We just did that on Mother's Day.
Oh, well, great.
You're feeding the birds. I mean, that's all right.
I don't like that. That's another show.
What if you put up a bird feeder and then did that? inundate them with black sunflower seed until your stuff sprouts.
All right, fair enough. Well, this was fun. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Greg Ward, who couldn't make it today, will be back with us in 2 weeks. All of those people on the line, I advise you to call again. And, you know, good luck. Thank you for everything. Thanks to Fred Breglia, Bob Graves, and thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thanks to Susie Chekai for screening the calls. Support comes from NatureWorks Organic Land Care, and specializing in ecological landscape construction of outdoor living spaces, landscape design, installation, and maintenance, natureworkslandcare.com. Watercolors by Edith Schutzbury. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors. Paintings of people and pets from emailed photographs. No contact required. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And KeyBank, working to serve the community beyond banking through philanthropy, volunteerism, and outreach. KeyBank.com/community for information. Once again, thanks to Fred, Bob, and everybody else, everybody who called in. Tomorrow on a program, once again, we'll bake with Gail Sokol. She's going to make some meringue pie. Join us for 2 p.m. at 2 p.m. for that one. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.